to kiss my cheek in a way he would never dare do at the office. Carter doesn't kiss my cheek, but he does offer a half smile.
Hey, Evie.
I smile at him, then turn to Brad. Just overheard you. A department trip to Vegas? How cool. My game face is always on. I wish it weren't the case, but I can never, ever let my guard down. Of course, Brad hasn't mentioned Vegas to me, and I would bet a large chunk of my salary that he hasn't mentioned it to Rose or Amy or any of the other female agents. The only vaginas they want on their trip are the ones 2 inches from their faces at the strip clubs.
Right,
Brad says, deflating just slightly, but hiding it pretty well. He's good at the game, too, after all.
You coming?
When is it again? I smile at him, letting him save face and act like he's mentioned this to me.
First week in March.
He shifts on his feet. No doubt he assumed that the female agents, who weren't invited or interested in hungover golfing in Las Vegas, would be fine without an invitation. An added bonus? We'd be here to put out any emergency weekend fires. Those of us who are left, anyway. And I'm up for renewal in February. Carter is March. Interesting. Should work for me. I smile over at Carter, whose expression tells me he's putting two and two together about the non-invites for the ladies. I want to hug him for working to be more aware of Brad's sexist shit, but also give him a patronizing head pat and a sing-song. Of course Brad didn't invite any of his girls, poodle.
Great,
Brad says, and flags down a passing waiter to bring him a scotch, neat.
You know, I meant to ask you the other day, but I have a friend who does a local podcast. Yeah, Here Today. Ever heard of it?
I shake my head. Can't say that I have.
Well, he's doing a series on career road bumps, and I was mentioning to him that you might be great as a guest.
Carter outwardly flinches. Embarrassment flashes across my skin, and I'm hoping I can keep the blood from flooding my face by sheer will alone. I force a tight smile. I'm intrigued.
Great, great,
he says, reaching for the drink set in front of him.
I'll connect you two. You get knocked down, but always manage to get yourself back up. That's what I like, sport. Good talking to you, Carter.
And with that, he pats us each on the shoulder in turn and moves on to the next conversation. Carter's expression shines with irritation. He's doing that thing that makes me insane, the quiet studying with those honest green eyes. And it feels so dangerous to be standing here with him in this setting which is somehow both work and social, and a little us against them. I can't resist him when he's like this. He looks gorgeous. His lips are slightly wet from his beer, eyes relaxing into that knowing glint, like he can read every thought I have and he finds each one amusing. I wish I could be more like him. And I realize with a slug to my gut that that's what a lot of this is for me. I've always been good at my job, but Carter has an easiness about him that I'll never be able to emulate. He's simply comfortable in his body, in his mind. I have to work so hard for every client, every deal, every second maintaining my level head. It's satisfying that I can make him insane sometimes, but it's short-lived. Still, I seem to get to him, too, in a way that I haven't seen anyone else do. I pull my lip between my teeth, thinking on this possibility that maybe Carter is a little hung up on me, too.
You look like you're cycling through a lot of things right now, he says.
Like what? He shrugs and steps a little closer.
Like whether you should kiss me or punch me?
The bald honesty of this makes my chest squeeze so tight I have a moment of breathlessness. It's a daily struggle. This seems to delight him.
Really? I was kidding. Friday aside, I figured you were mostly up for the punching.
It is heavily favored.
If it makes you feel any better, I struggle similarly.
He pauses, taking a sip of his beer.
Alas, kissing is usually favored.
I swallow, working to contain my outward reaction to this. My shoulders go up in this external, tiny squeal, and I lift my drink to my lips to mask it as a shiver from the chill.
"Should we talk about that?" he asks quietly.
I'm opening my mouth to tell him, yes, absolutely, but not here, when a floppy arm comes around me. I startle, and Rose appears at my side, bringing with her a heavy whiff of tequila.
"Evie!"
"Hey, Rose." I smile as she presses a wet kiss to my cheek. Amy comes up behind her, and I get the distinct impression she's been keeping an eye on Rose's booze intake.
"Hey, guys," she says.
Rose leans in closer.
"You're amazing."
The word is drawn out into several syllables and brings out the lime smell just on the edge of the tequila. I laugh at this, working to gently step out of her embrace.
"Aw, thanks." "No, I mean it. You're my girl hero."
I look up at Carter's face and bite back a laugh at the surprised amusement there. For once, he doesn't seem annoyed to hear someone compliment me.
"Just your girl hero?" Carter asks, laughing. "My hero hero. Rose has had a really good party," Amy says with a smile and a nod.
"Rose, honey, are you ready to head out yet? I can drop you on my way." Rose waves her off and looks at Carter, giving him a very long, very drunken once over.
"Hey, Carter."
He laughs, cheeks a little pink.
"Hey, Rose."
He slips one hand in his pocket and gazes back at my face. Something inside me pulls tight, a string being tied around my midsection, at the way his attention to me is a quiet statement about where his thoughts are and who he's here for. I get caught in that look, snagged by it.
"Evie,"
Rose stage whispers into my ear, and I shiver from the wet condensation of her breath on my neck.
"Any chance we'll get to be Eskimo sisters on this one?"
This question comes like a bucket of ice poured over my head, and I step away, fully out of her arm now, shaking my head.
"I'm not sure that has anything to do with me."
I look up at Carter but can't tell whether he's heard. I want to take Rose's drink away, lead her to a couch where she can sit down and get some air, maybe sober up. Turning, I collide directly with Brad's chest.
"I see Rose has her fifth margarita,"
he says with a laugh, caught somewhere between reprimand and pride.
"Fourth,"
Rose says, and then adds,
"but these are strong."
Without preamble, Brad lifts his chin to her, asking,
"You gonna pick up the pace this quarter, Rosie?"
I feel my face heat at the patronizing Rosie and the work performance question thrown so sharply down into the small circle of us standing there. Rose flushes too and says,
"Oh yeah, Q3 was just an outlier for me."
She looks away, glancing out the back doors, and sips her drink as we all drown in awkward silence.
"Well, not so much of an outlier,"
Brad says, bringing her back into it.
"The rest of the team is crushing deals left and right. Ashton signed 3 majors this month. Carter got Jet Payne a recurring spot on a Netflix show and a starring role in a Ridley Scott movie. Evie has Sarah Hill in this year's biggest teen craze. I think you're going to need to figure out where you fit into the puzzle."
"If I do,"
Rose says, and never before have I wanted to escape a conversation more than this one.
"Sometimes I look at someone like Evie and wonder if I'm cut out for this. I mean, I love it, okay, but..."
Carter and I meet eyes and quickly look away. This is painful for both of us. I want to tell Rose to stop. I want to tell her she's gone too far. This is a conversation for closed doors with me or someone else who's sympathetic, not here. 7 days of the week, even on holidays, Brad is out to win. He's not going to worry about appearances and say something to ease her mind. He's a predator, and if you show him a trail of blood, he will hunt you down until he's eating your entrails. Graphic, but true.
Just depends,
Brad says with menacing quiet.
Whether you're more comfortable being a failure or a quitter.
I down my wine, knowing I'll regret drinking it so fast, but also unable to stop myself because I need to do something other than stand here listening to Brad give this poor, nice person her very negative year-end review in the middle of a party. Snagging another glass from a passing tray, I turn and walk toward the Christmas tree, intent on admiring it and getting the hell away from the echo of that conversation. But I can feel Carter on my heels, and he stops just behind me, staying quiet while we each take a few breaths.
Wow,
he says quietly, and I nod. A few more seconds pass before he whispers,
Evie?
Yeah?
What are Eskimo sisters?
The anticipatory horror on his face when I turn is like a hammer to a pane of glass for the tension in my chest, and I burst out laughing. Two women who have slept with the same man. If possible, the horror intensifies.
And this man would be me?
I presume so, but I know I didn't become a sister. His face straightens.
Only because of circumstances.
I assume whenever two people don't sleep together, one way or another, it's because of circumstances.
Right,
he says, easy again now, with the smile and the eyes and the collarbones.
But those circumstances are entirely different from the ones surrounding why I didn't sleep with Rose.
I glance back over to where Rose is still in a tense conversation with Brad, having been abandoned by the rest of us. I want to joke some more, keep it light here with Carter, but it's nearly impossible when the weight of the job seems to follow us everywhere. I've never been let go. I'm not even sure how to deal with that.
You okay?
I nod, numb. Sometimes I just can't believe I do this for a living. His brows pull together.
You don't love it?
Instinct makes me tread carefully. Why is it that the one person I want to confide in the most is the one who could use it against me so easily? I do love it. I love making these things happen and connecting people. I love the clients and the art they make. It's the politics I hate. The team behind the curtain is starting to feel terrible. I don't want to become that. His hand is warm when it comes up and cups my shoulder. The touch feels like the most intimate thing he could do right now, beyond even kissing me, because it makes me remember. I remember his mouth there. I remember that Carter likes my shoulders. I remember how his eyes seemed to ignite when he saw them bare in the dress that first date, and again on Friday. It doesn't feel like an innocent touch. It feels like a message.
You aren't like that, Evie.
But when I look up at his face, he smiles a little, and it carries a shadow of regret. I know we're thinking the same thing, but I've been like that with you.
Chapter 20. Carter. 18-hour workdays, no social life, and I'm boarding the plane for New York wondering if the fact that it's December 21st and the only Los Angeles holiday parties I managed to attend were work-related makes me an amazing career man or a terrible single dude. Michael Christopher and Steph were hosting one, no costumes this time, sadly, but it conflicted with the Paramount party. Jonah invited me to his new apartment in West Hollywood, but the only evening I was free overlapped with his meeting a bankruptcy lawyer. We ended up exchanging small gifts over lunch at a food truck outside my building. I've barely seen Evie, but we seem to have reached a sort of ceasefire. I guess hand jobs foster goodwill? Or maybe it was because I told her she had a poppy seed between her teeth before a Monday meeting, and she gave me a grateful, you no longer Satan look. Whatever the reason, things have softened between us, and I'm so goddamn grateful for it I nearly want to weep. I've never in my life been so busy at a job, so desperate to prove myself and make myself indispensable. But seeing her face as we pass in the hall, or hearing her voice coming from her office, has made the last 3 weeks more bearable. It makes no sense, I realize that. Hers should be the voice that reminds me that the clock is ticking, that the direct deposit notice I find in my inbox every 2 weeks isn't a sure thing. And still, hers is the presence that feels the most grounding, the most sane. It's terrifying to realize that no matter how this turns out, I probably won't have her as a colleague much longer. So I go into ostrich mode and just don't think about it. Christmas is in 2 days, and I'm shopping with family. The mall is packed, but there's this shared type of last-minute chaos that puts people in a good mood despite the number of bodies clogging the stores. Doris and Dolores are my two favorite aunts. They're my dad's sisters. Twins, of course. And although they might look identical, they couldn't be more different. For as long as I can remember, if Doris was hot, Dolores was cold. If Doris wanted burgers for dinner, Dolores wanted fish. If one wanted to watch a comedy, the other was absolutely in the mood for sci-fi. "Why so quiet, Scooter?" Doris says, apparently still refusing to believe I am nearing 30. She peers at me across the clothing rack through glasses so thick her blue eyes are magnified to 3 times their actual size. "What are you thinking about?" Dolores picks through a table piled high with brightly colored polo shirts and looks up at her sister. "He's a boy. He's not thinking about anything." I slide my eyes to her. "Easy, Dolores." Holiday music plays on a loop overhead and Doris squints at me. "Look at him. He's percolating." My mom lays a gentle hand on my shoulder. "You stressed about work, honey?" As far as she knows, work is fine. I haven't told her that in the past 2 months her eldest son began bronzing women without their consent and dealing in contraband glitter and hot sauce. I haven't told her about my boss and how it's like working for a real-life Ron Burgundy. I certainly haven't told her that there's a small chance I could be transferred back here, because the sabotage I've seen from Evie would pale in comparison to what Mom would do to make that transfer happen. And I haven't mentioned that the girl I met at the party all those months ago is becoming my favorite person in the world, and I'm feeling mildly lovesick. "Just wondering," I say, pointing at the pile of shirts Dolores is upturning, "what kind of monster digs through clothes during Christmas shopping and pulls every single shirt from the pile, unfolding it?" Dolores throws me the stink eye. "Don't you know how long it takes to fold all of those, Double D?" I started calling my aunts this long before I knew or appreciated what it meant. They've always found it hilarious, but after 20-plus years of hearing it, my mom no longer finds humor in Double D, the twins. She gives my aunts a reproachful look for encouraging me by laughing. I adjust the bags in my hands and follow her as she moves to another table.
"Honey," she says, "tell me what's bothering you. Are you in some kind of trouble? You know, I saw this episode of Law and Order where it talked about the underbelly of Hollywood."
She lowers her voice on that last part, the tiny bells on her earrings jingling as she sorts through shirts.
"Anyway, they exposed it all, about the prostitutes and gangs, the drug dealers."
She looks at me with wide eyes.
"You're not near that, are you?"
"No, Mom, I think the underbelly is on the other side of L.A., the side Jonah is on." This time the reproachful look is all mine.
"Mom, I'm fine.
Was just thinking about him, actually, wondering if he's going to be all alone on Christmas." I am an excellent manipulator, and if there's one thing I've learned growing up in this family, it's that the way to change the tide of any conversation is to steer it directly toward Jonah. Mom frowns, and even though I'm sure she knows exactly what I'm doing, her desire to defend her can-do-no-wrong son wins out.
"You know how busy he is," she says to me,
but also toward Dolores and Doris, who've stopped to listen.
"He said he'd be fine. He has friends. I'm sure he has some important job he's wrapped up in, it being the holidays and all."
I nod, remaining silent on the topic of Jonah's schedule. Old Carter would have spilled all the details about my brother's fall from grace, his money troubles, his current adventures in bankruptcy, because, at least for a few minutes, it would mean I'm the good one. But this strange guarded sensation in my chest feels something like protectiveness. Toward Jonah. I think I might be starting to like him.
"He does have a lot on his plate," I say.
My mom puts down a particularly hideous shirt and pins me with narrowed eyes.
"This is usually the point where you call him something colorful and tell me how many days it's been since he last visited."
"Maybe I'm being a grown-up."
"Maybe you're full of it,"
she counters. And there it is. There's that little spark I love. I sometimes wonder how much Mom knows about the particulars of Jonah's life. They obviously talk because he told her about Evie, but he rarely comes home, and getting my parents onto a metallic death tube piloted by alcoholics, their words, is unlikely. I'm 28 years old and moved out of my parents' house when I was 19, but I still miss my mom sometimes, my dad, the rest of my crazy family. I'm not really sure how Jonah does it. Then again, maybe that's exactly how. If he came home, she'd probably figure out what a mess he is right now. Maybe he'd rather be the perfect Jonah they all remember than the one he actually is. L.A. is just a lot, I say, finally, lamely. It must communicate what I mean it to, because Mom nods, refolds the terrible shirt. Just be sure you don't become a lot, too. I sit in the back seat next to Doris on our way back to the house. 10 minutes into the drive, she's asleep, which doesn't make for the best conversation, but does allow me to scroll through my texts and maybe mope a bit without anyone reading over my shoulder. I'm not going to lie. It's a little depressing to open my text window with Evie and realize how much time has passed since things were so good between us. I start to reread some of our exchanges, wondering if it's possible I made then Evie out to be funnier, smarter, or sexier than she really was. I didn't. The Evie in these texts is just like I remembered, and basically just like the one I see every day. Maybe with just a touch more fire. My phone rings as I'm carrying packages into the house, and I double-take when I see the name on the screen. Zach Barker is one of my stage-to-film clients. He was offered a last-minute role in an action movie when one of the supporting cast had to be replaced. Despite the fact that he and his wife Avia were living in New York and expecting a second child, he was needed on set right away. It wasn't an ideal situation, but the last I heard, Avia decided to stay behind and wait for their son to finish up the fall semester before joining Zach in California around the time the baby is due. Zach, hey, I say into the receiver, looking up to see snow beginning to fall. You back in New York? I'm still in L.A. Avia and Josh are there. That's why I'm calling. My heart speeds up, and my mind races with thoughts of impending disaster. Tell me what's going on. Jason broke his ankle, he says, and I wince. Jason Dover, the lead. Okay, what does this mean? I ask, walking to the edge of the driveway. We're almost done, so they think they can shoot the remaining scenes around him and use a double for the rest, but they had to rearrange the shooting schedule, and I won't be home until tomorrow. Do you want me to call someone, or what can I do? I need to call in a favor from Friend Carter, not Agent Carter. Yeah, whatever you need. He laughs. You might regret that in a second. Let's hear it. I was supposed to make it back yesterday, in time to go with Avia to a birthing class tonight. To what? I bark out a laugh, and a cloud of condensation hangs in the air in front of me. My mom's little garden is frozen over, forgotten vines covered in ice and snow. A group of teens huddle together on a corner a few houses down, the end of a joint glowing in the fading daylight. Yeah, Zach says, trailing off before laughing again. I told you. I squeeze my eyes closed, pinching the bridge of my nose. No, it's cool. You are such a liar. Are you sure Avia's fine with this? Avia and I knew each other before she started dating Zach, but I don't want her to be uncomfortable. She's the one who suggested you. I open my eyes, staring at the foggy, snowy sky. I love the day-to-day interactions with my clients. This is just an odd one. How could I possibly say no? Birthing class it is. If you were to have asked me what I thought I might be doing tonight, there are a lot of answers I could have given you. Xbox with my cousins, wrapping presents with Double D, rereading Evil's old texts again and again until I eat a box of ice cream sandwiches solo and blame it on my dad somehow. The possibility of ending up with someone else's wife in a room full of pregnant women and their partners would not have occurred to me. Yet here I am. I meet Avia out front and we hug, exchanging a few pleasantries and a comment or two about the weather. It's a little awkward at first because I don't know where to look or what to say, or really even how to hug a very, very pregnant woman. Per usual, Avia breaks the ice. Ready to go talk about my vaginal birth? She says, yoga mat rolled up under one arm. I don't even know what to say to this. With a smile, I open the door, motion for her to lead, and follow her inside. As far as birthing classes go, this one doesn't seem too bad. It's in a large open space and feels a lot like hanging out in sweatpants in a friend's living room. It's a plus if you're trying to keep things natural, I guess. Natural seems to be an ongoing theme, managing pain as best you can through natural methods, but not placing judgment on yourself or anyone else if a situation arises where you change your mind. And aside, if modern science ever figures out a way for men to experience the miracle of birth, put me down for no. If the no option is full, I'll take drugs. Lots of them. Our teacher's name is Meredith. She's knowledgeable and soft-spoken and walks from couple to couple, adjusting posture and widening a stance or moving a foot here and there. We go through a series of stretches, the first with all of us on our hands and knees, gently rocking our hips back and forth in some sort of air hump. And I am so glad in this moment that Avia and I never had sex before Zach came along. "That's good," Meredith says, looking out over the class. "Arch that back. Swing those hips in a figure eight. Feel the motion. Back and forth, back and forth. Enjoy that movement, because who knows when you'll feel it again after this. Am I right?" Avia catches my eye over her shoulder for a beat before we dissolve into laughter. "God, Evie will not believe this," I say, helping Avia into the next position.
"Evie, Evie," she repeats slowly. "Don't think Zach's mentioned that name before."
"She's an agent back in L.A.
"Same agency?"
"Yeah, sort of. It's a long story."
"You're dating an agent you work with? My life is so boring right now. Thank God I made Zach ask you to come."
"Not dating." Even I hear the "ooh, girls" implied by my tone.
"Snooze,"
Avia complains, bending forward, her long black hair hiding her face.
"Then why would she particularly care about this class? Entertain me, Carter."
"She was with P&D before the merge," I say, and Avia nods. "Anyway, she goes with the wife and child of one of her clients to a sensory class in Beverly Hills." "Let me guess, they paid the equivalent of 1 month's rent on a one-bedroom in Queens to have their kids play in some totally basic thing, like pudding or bedsheets?"
"Pasta, actually. How'd you know?"
"I went to something similar when Joshua was little, but with parachutes."
"Parachutes?"
"We adopted Joshua from his birth mother when he was newborn," she explains. "So I missed the whole birthing thing with him, hence this class." She gives me another smile over her shoulder. "We laid all the babies down in a big circle, and all the mommies lifted this giant circus tent-looking parachute over them, fanning it up and down. It sounds great in theory, but the babies were just way too young to enjoy it. You're basically yanking this parachute out of their faces and scaring the shit out of them. Half are crying, a few are trying to get away, and the rest are too scared to move."
"Oh my God," I say, biting my lip and looking around for the instructor. The last thing I need is to get a client's wife kicked out of her birthing class.
"I'm sorry, that's not funny."
"Oh, it's totally funny. As parents, we put our kids through the strangest things because we think it's giving them some sort of advantage."
The instructor has the mothers-to-be move into a squat that looks a lot like they're sitting on a toilet, and explains the benefits of this position, including what it's doing for the perineum, and some other things I can't focus on.
"How's the perineum?" I say. "Good?"
Avia shakes her head like she can't believe we're doing this.
"Relaxed. Thanks. Now, more about this Evie."
I sigh, then just let it all out.
"Simply put, Evelyn Abbey is my former almost-girlfriend-turned-arch-nemesis-turned-tentative-ally, whom I would very much now like to permanently seduce."
The glee on Avia's face tells me I should continue. "It's a long, complicated story involving first dates followed by corporate greed, competing for a single position, and sabotage."
"Okay, that is decidedly not as fun as I imagined."
"The thing is, she's smart and gorgeous and funny and amazing at her job, and it was infuriating. We were essentially told they could only keep one of us, and it made us into maniacs. I'd be listening to her in a meeting, totally mesmerized. Then I would snap back to the conversation and want to let the air out of her tires for distracting me from my goal."
"And your goal was?"
"Total annihilation, of course." We move to the next seated position, with Avia in front of me and between my legs, her back against my chest.
"And now?"
she asks.
"Now she seems like the best person there."
"Have you two..." she starts, letting the question hang in the space between us while she practices her breathing exercises. I mean, almost. There was some under-the-clothes touching to completion, if you know what I'm saying. She snickers. And it was good? Fuck. Yeah. I'm assuming you'd definitely like to do it again. Shouldn't you be focusing on something wholesome? I ask. How can I be expected to focus when there's all this forbidden love and pining going on? You can focus, because at this point I fear there's a better chance of me touching to completion with any one of these ladies, I say, motioning to the pregnant women around us, than there is with Evie. Why? Because of the job? That feels like a detail to me. It's a pretty big detail, though. We're both married to our jobs, the jobs that may not even be around in 3 months. Not to mention we have this retreat thing and Big Bear coming up. I want to be around her, but we always fight. I really don't want us to end up stabbing each other. She's too bossy for prison, and I have a hard time saying no. Okay, so big question here, Avya says. Would you be with her if there were no job or anything else on the line? That's a pretty fucking big if, Avya. You didn't answer the question, Carter. Would I be with Evie if there was nothing else in the way? Probably. I scratch my jaw, wincing at this cop-out. No, not probably. For sure I would. So fix it. Oh my God, why didn't I think of that? Carter, women are not that complicated, Avya says, half-turning and smiling back at me. Smarter, yes. Complicated? Not really. We want progress, not perfection. That night at my parents' house, I think about what Avya said. Progress, not perfection. I don't have to be perfect. I don't necessarily even have to fix everything with Evie, but I can at least own up to the things I did that even I'm not okay with. I can try to be a little less terrible. Reaching across the bed, I find my phone where it's charging on the table. I scroll through the conversations until I find the one labeled evil and open it. I do the time zone math in my head. Just after 10 here, just after 7 there. Definitely not too late. Hey. I hold my breath, staring at the phone, hoping to see the little dots indicating she's typing. Just when I let out a long exhale and start to put my phone down, the bubble pops up. My heart bounces into my throat. Hey, you. Here goes. Time to get it all out there. I feel like I need to go back a bit. Starting with, I should have called you to talk about Dan Prince first. I should have told you your shirt was unbuttoned. I should have asked you about Jonah doing the shoot. Have you been visited by the ghost of Christmas past? Something like that. Well, thanks. No problem. I can't apologize for the glitter, though. The glitter was pretty great. And honestly, I'm sorry, too. But not for the onion. You're forgiven. The onion was terrible/genius. The mixing room, however, was enjoyable. Will she appreciate my understating the obvious? Will she agree? Another minute goes by. My heart is basically inside my mouth, in my eyes, pounding my head off. Finally, my phone vibrates again. You can say that again. I exhale and roll into my pillow. Thank God. Are you in New York? Yeah. What are you up to? I had dinner with Daryl, and I have to finish up my expense reports before I go to Burbank tomorrow. Expense reports over the holiday? Hiss. I know, but I think I'm the only one they're waiting on to finish up the audit. What is it they think they're going to find? The vodka I expensed after dealing with Brad? I bet that's a whole lot of vodka. Well, by the case makes it cheaper, at least. You'll see Michael and Steph while you're there? They usually stay with Steph's parents, so yeah. Is it weird that I'm excited to get together with them out here? Like, we live in the same city. It makes no sense. It's because you miss partying at Areola. I put a hand over my mouth to stifle a laugh, having forgotten I told her about that. Are we flirting? Is that what this is? She's bringing up our past conversations, and I'm being, what, charmed by it? Think of something clever, Carter. Noted. Nailed it. Can you do me a dumb favor? I live for dumb favors. If you do something outdoorsy, can you take a picture of the snow? That's not really that dumb. I'm disappointed. California Christmas not doing it for you? Maybe. How's this? I'll make a snow angel and even write your name next to it. As long as it's not in yellow. In yellow? You'll get there. Wait for it. Oh. Oh. Bazinga. You're broken. I think you like it. Good night, Carter. Night, Evie.
Chapter 21. Evie. My first morning back to work after the holidays, I am a mess of nerves. It's impossible to keep my calm, reasonable voice in my head because it's basically closed up shop for the winter. Carter walks into work in what my stalker tendencies tell me is a new outfit and looks breathtaking. His pants are charcoal gray and slim cut, stopping just at his ankles and exposing a little flash of some exuberant socks. Are guys taking over the ankle flirtation game? I am here for it. His shirt is a cool purple print, and in general he just looks way too hip, even for an office full of Hollywood power players. I'm standing in the doorway to the break room, watching his path from the elevators in total awe, but my world trips when he stops at my office and tentatively peeks in. Obviously, I'm not there. I call out to him, my heart dropping somewhere in the vicinity of my vagina when he turns toward my voice and smiles. Man, I am in deep. I brought you something. He walks toward me and holds out a cellophane-wrapped package. The tape is barely holding together, and the ribbon looks like it was used as a handle. Cookies. From my mom. You brought me cookies all the way from New York? I ask, handling the small package carefully. Whether he intended it or not, Carter seems to realize the implication of this.
There were a lot of extras.
He gives me an adorable, self-deprecating smile.
I made it weird, didn't I?
My heart is thrumming, my skin is all flushed, and the vision of grabbing him by the collar and kissing him is flashing like a Vegas billboard in my head.
No, it's sweet.
I gingerly pull apart the wrapper. The scent of chocolate and butter fills the air.
Carter,
Kylie says, winded as she jogs up.
I'm glad I found you.
He turns to her.
I just got in. What's up?
Brad wanted to know if you had a chance to look over the scripts he sent you.
Oh, not yet,
he says, clearly caught off guard.
I only saw the email last night.
Kylie laughs easily.
He wanted me to follow up. I was like, Brad, there were five of them. Give him time.
Carter laughs easily now, too, but my own smile is totally forced. A gallon of ice water could not have changed the tone of this conversation any quicker. It's not that Brad doesn't forward along a script to an agent when he has someone in mind from said agent's list. It's just that he doesn't send five out to one agent. I'm trying to keep calm, but is this the golf weekend thing all over again?
Brad sent you some scripts? I ask.
Yeah. For one, he wants to give the screenwriter some feedback and asked for my thoughts.
I see.
I put the plate of cookies down on a nearby table.
Brad also wants Carter to help him decide how to best distribute to the team,
Kylie adds helpfully. I bite my lower lip to keep my jaw from falling open. So now I need to position myself with Carter in order to have him send work my client's way? When I'm sure I can ask it without yelling, I say,
Just Carter?
Yes, just Carter,
Kylie says, shrugging a little helplessly.
We've finally arrived here. I can't even say I'm surprised.
I do have some experience in this,
he says, with a gentle lean to his voice.
In New York, I did some playwright work. For what it's worth, I also have a decent eye for pairing talent with roles.
I nod, forcing another smile.
Why do Carter and I do so much better when we're not in the same room? After the texts, I was so excited to see him, and now I'm confused all over again about who he is. It's like fate keeps telling us there's just no way to make it work. He glances quickly over to Kylie, who is watching us with flat curiosity.
Well, I say, swallowing my pride, let me know if you need some help, okay?
Carter nods, but I don't stick around to see if he'll say anything else. I'm so worked up, I can barely concentrate. The worst part of being this mad is that I'm no longer rational.
I hear Carter talking on his phone with his door open, and I want to hurl a stapler at him for being loud enough for me to hear.
I hear Brad thanking Kylie for the coffee she's handed him in the hall, and I want to yell, "If she was a male assistant, would you expect him to bring you coffee every goddamn hour?" And I'm so angry that when my phone buzzes with a text from Carter, I can't even read it. I flip my phone face down when a second comes in, a third, a fourth, and dive into the process of answering emails, returning calls, and making deals. In essence, the anger fuels me, and if I don't have 5 hot scripts in my inbox, at least I have a motherfucking productive day. Only when I'm home later, way past 9, and with a fishbowl-sized glass of wine in my hand, do I read what he wrote.
It's time for us to cut the shit. I don't know what kind of game Brad is playing, but I get that I'm coming out favored in part because I'm a guy, and that's fucked up. I like you. I liked us. I don't know how to manage this weird competition. I need you to tell me how I can fix this.
The problem with deciding to cut the shit is that it's easier said than done. I could reply to his texts, addressing everything, but in a lot of ways that feels like cheating. We know we can text. We know we can get along outside of work. What we can't seem to do, yet, is interact like rational humans when we're together at the office. And given that approximately 98% of my life revolves around my job, I can't just accept the text and out-of-work approach to our relationship. So I reply with a simple, "I feel the same about all of this. Let's talk more in person. That's where we always get stuck." And try to get to bed early. Life has to go on. And because we all took time off to be with family for the holidays, there are a million things to handle. We each have endless producers to follow up with, staffing season to plan, directors and actors to call and cajole, schedules to massage. It all makes me want to sledgehammer Brad for thinking mid-January was a good time for the department retreat. And my nerves climb higher in my throat with each day that passes without my speaking a word to Carter. I feel Brad's New York decision looming like a dark thundercloud. It's only about a 2-hour drive from L.A. to Big Bear, but because we'd all planned to drive ourselves and everyone works until the last second, we end up leaving at the worst possible time, 4 in the afternoon on a Friday. And yet, when I come outside, everyone is happily piling into a handful of limos parked out front. A swank ride up to the retreat. A surprise from Brad.
"Limos!" Rose cries. And 8-year-old me can totally relate to the excitement of this, though 33-year-old me remains cynical.
"Gotta treat my people well, don't I?"
Brad says magnanimously and claps me on the back.
"I have high hopes that this retreat is the best one yet. Don't let me down, kiddo."
"And Carter,"
Carter adds with a nervous laugh, but Brad doesn't hear him. Carter and I exchange brief looks, and despite the unspoken everything between us, I know we're both thinking the same thing. Brad wouldn't increase the budget for the lunch we planned, so we had to do a lame sandwich bar. Yet, he can be the big guy and bring everyone to the retreat in limos? Jess grabs me as we're about to head out, dropping a small stack of files in my arms.
"The invoices for this little adventure," she says, slightly out of breath. "Sorry that took so long, but the mailroom said they were labeled to go to Brad, and I basically had to wrestle them away."
She opens the one on top.
"There are a bunch of vendors here I didn't book, so have a look to make sure it's all there, and we can talk when you're back."
"Thanks, Jess," I say, and take a deep, cleansing breath. "I can do this," I remind myself.
"I wish you were coming with us."
"Ha!
not to hurt your feelings, but hell no. Good luck, and...
She looks meaningfully over my shoulder to where Carter is climbing into one of the cars.
Have fun.
Right. Fun. Amelia and Daryl stand near the sidewalk, waving and smiling there.
Good luck, you'll need it,
smiles. I give them my best. I wish you were suffering along with me, assholes, smile in return before climbing into the limo. As nice as it would be to talk and smooth out some last-minute details during the drive up, Carter and I end up sitting on opposite ends of our car. Andrew and Carter exchange glances as their eyes wander over the minibar, calculating how long we need to sit here before they can pop into the champagne. According to Andrew, that duration is approximately the time it takes us to pull away from the front of the building. I, for one, am giving that decision hallelujah hands and a hell yes, because we need this entire crew to have as good a time as possible, and that means getting everyone day drunk immediately. With a glass of bubbly headed my way, and my inability to do any work in the car for fear of getting carsick, I can only join in the shenanigans. Timothy shit-talks Ed Ruiz from Alterman for a little while. Apparently he did some shady things to pull a potential client out from under Timothy, and I silently enjoy the hell out of the story he's telling because Ed is a complete fuckwit.
Didn't you work with him? Andrew asks me.
Yeah, but not much directly. And that's all I'm going to give. I won't share the time that he vomited on my shoes in a cab on our way back from a work dinner, or that he slept with Ken Alterman's assistant and got so obsessed with her that he kept her underwear in a drawer in his desk, or that he once reassured an actor on his list that it was totally fine that he accidentally had sex with a 17-year-old and that Ed would be happy to hide any evidence. Gossip is fun. Don't get me wrong, I live for it, but I'm rarely the one letting on that I have anything exciting to share. So when Andrew starts telling us about how he saw a very huge A-list actress at a full nudity sex club with a very important and very old male director, I tuck this story away in a little jewel box in my memory. No one bothers to ask why the hell Andrew was there, mind you. After everyone's spent their gossip currency, we still have over an hour left to drive, and we shift into the kind of silence that will result in at least three of us falling asleep with the champagne drowsies. I can see Kylie working up the nerve to move over toward Carter, and it is exactly like watching some elaborate bird mating ritual. She crouch walks from her spot next to me at the back of the limo and sits next to Carter on the side bench, slowly scooting closer, leaning in like she wants to read over his shoulder, but, I mean, he's reading a contract. I can tell by the legal paper and prong fastener at the top. This isn't canoodling reading. This is legalese pouring off the page like a violent mudslide. Kylie does this weird cat-like stretch and then slides her arm behind her a little so she's pressing her boob to his shoulder. Carter startles, shifting away on instinct, and suddenly I am living.
Hey,
she says, looking at him like she's admiring herself in a hand mirror.
Hey,
he says, smiling briefly at her before returning to the papers on his lap.
Excited for the trip?
He nods.
Yeah, should be good.
Have you ever stayed at the Big Bear Lodge and Suites before?
Nope.
It's really nice,
she tells him.
Big bar, big cozy lobby, big rooms.
And now I'm uncomfortable for them both because, Lord, she is laying it on thick. He looks up and catches me eavesdropping, so I look away, but it's a horribly executed startle blink, and I have to pretend that I have something in my eye, which I don't, which we both know. When I look back at Carter, he's still several inches away from Kylie, and he's still watching me, clearly wondering just how jealous I am right now. Carter's smile this time isn't cocky or teasing. It's happy. Just pure, quiet happy. Maybe cutting the shit in person won't be impossible after all. For once, the reality lives up to the hype. the resort really is beautiful. Set near the top of one of the summits, the main building is an immense log cabin-style lodge with several deluxe small cabins surrounding it. Towering ponderosa pines cluster around the grounds, and the air is so crisp it feels a little like I've never been outside before. The L.A. Basin is notoriously smoggy, being trapped between the mountains and the marine layer, and although it's much better than it was when I was a kid, it still makes it easy to forget the sensation of truly fresh air. I feel pretty optimistic as we emerge from the limos, squinting into the brilliant sun. The snowpack is light this year, but at least it's there. Even if everything else about this weekend sucks, it's beautiful and promises a lot of alcohol. Brad stops us all outside the grand entrance, decorated with gold tassels and an impeccable red carpet, leading from the curved driveway to the wide lobby.
Welcome to the P&D Features 7th Annual Retreat.
We clap politely, the most awkward round of applause ever witnessed.
Thank you for taking the time to join me this weekend, he continues. I want to thank each of you for your commitment to the agency and your continued dedication. Needless to say, it's been an interesting year.
A small laugh moves through the group.
Understatement of the decade, am I right?
He adds, looking at the assembled crowd of agents and staff.
But none of that matters, because this, right here, this is what it's all about. Seeing my team around me, ready to really show the world how it's done. Now, more than ever, we need talent that can do it all. TV, film, media, and they need a team behind them that can do it all, too. That's why I have you all here together, where you can learn to cheer each other on and become unstoppable. How do we do that?
As a team, someone says, and Brad nods.
That's right. Not two individual companies, but as a team.
Brad stops to look around before waving me to the front of the group.
Now come on up here, Evie. You've done a great job as event planner. Tell us what we can expect for the night. Dazzle us.
Carter looks to me, frowning. We have a welcome dinner in the lodge, I tell them, glancing at my watch. In about 45 minutes. That should give everyone time to drop off their things and get sorted. The real fun starts tomorrow at 10. At my side, Brad nods enthusiastically.
Can't wait. Now I can tell you guys are chomping at the bit to get rolling. Let's go check in, team.
Looking up, I meet Carter's eyes. His expression is grim, his mouth a slash of disapproval. Brad claps me on the back, shooting me forward toward the doors of the lodge.
Lead the way, kiddo.
Sweet, hellacious hellfire. This weekend is going to be a doozy. When we all split off with room keys in our hands, I could be a CIA agent the way I covertly watch which way Carter goes, and also maybe which direction Kylie goes too, celebrating internally when they turn down opposite halls. I wheel my small suitcase behind me to 207, a few doors away from Rose. Inside, it's gorgeous, with an enormous bed in the middle of a spacious room and a breathtaking view of the lake beyond a wide balcony. I mentally high-five Kylie for securing such a great deal with this place and walk outside to get a better look at the view. It's never cold enough for the lake to freeze over, and so deep blue water laps gently against frost-covered rocks at the shore. The trees are brilliant green, speckled with white, and for just a moment, a tiny, perfect inhale? I am absolutely giddy to be here. Knowing I have a few minutes, I step back inside and pull the files Jess gave me from my bag. Jess's record-keeping is usually flawless, but when I glance over the retreat vendors she mentioned, I see what she meant. I don't recall most of them either. I'm in the middle of sending her a note to verify some of the entries with Kylie when my phone buzzes on the table with a text to me, and only me, from Brad. Please arrive to the lodge restaurant early to ensure everything is in order. I give myself exactly 3 deep,
what the actual hell is up with Brad breaths before I find my purse and my key and head downstairs. As it happens, dinner is lovely. Or at least it is after Brad thanks everyone again for coming and asks me to get in front of the group and explain what we can expect on tonight's menu. I move from my seat, but the tension in my spine over being treated like his assistant or an event coordinator is slowly ratcheting tighter.
"I'm happy to explain the menu,"
Carter interrupts, beginning to stand. Brad shakes his head.
"Let Evie do it."
I hear Brad's message loud and clear, aimed at me. "You're my puppet. You'll do this if you want a job come Monday." Slowly, Carter sits down, his face red. I give him a little nod and smile, grateful for his attempt at least, and rattle off the basics. Salad, meat, potatoes, green beans. It's really nothing in need of explanation. Carter was smart to insist we go with traditional on our rather limited budget, knowing that they probably prepare it pretty nicely up at the lodge. We'd also selected a white wine and a red wine, and we run out of both before we're done with the salad course. Thank God for the cash bar, I guess. Forks and knives scrape and screech across porcelain as everyone chows down. We're at a small handful of long tables in the center of a cavernous private room, but I can't really accept blame for the oddity of this, since it was on Brad's list of demands that we take our meal here. Together. Like a team. A fire roars in a stone fireplace so enormous I could probably stand inside, and there are 7 waiters milling timidly around the room, hoping they can be helpful in some way, but unwilling to ask too often. It's the Brad Kingman effect. You don't even have to know who he is to be mildly afraid of him. Carter is at my left during dinner, and it's strange to be in a room full of people and sounds and yet still be so aware of him. His arm brushes against mine as he cuts his steak, as he reaches for his wine, as he adjusts his napkin below the table. Is he trying to touch me? The more wine I have, the more my brain screams yes to this question, and I start to reciprocate a little, leaning closer, resting my left arm lightly on the table so he has easier access. Subtle stuff. I am a seduction ninja. I'm so focused on what Carter's doing and saying and how amazing he smells that I'm somewhat startled when a few of the waiters start clearing plates and I look down to realize I've barely touched mine. The party transitions to the outdoor patio where heat lamps glow from each corner and strings of paper lanterns frame a view of the lake just beyond. Brad rarely lets go enough to really get drunk at these things, but when he does, he's one of those intoxicated people who seems to have a volume knob attached to his drinking arm. By the time 10 o'clock rolls around, most of the group is pretty tanked, but Brad isn't just tanked. It's like he's hooked up to some PA system. Don't get me wrong. Fewer people have better stories in this business than Brad Kingman, and sober, he's as sealed as a 200-year-old grave. So we're all, even the ones who hate him, pretty enthralled. Tonight, he is really on a roll. Some highlights. His wife paid for college by stripping. I'm sure Maxine, the studio executive, would be thrilled he's shared this. He watched one of the most famous actors in the history of film, 5 Academy Awards to be exact, do some blow off a hooker's ass in Vegas. The first time he met one of the industry's most powerful producers, said producer was so high he fell asleep in his salad, woke up, and pretended nothing had happened. He finished the meeting with shredded carrots in his hair and a smear of French dressing along the entire left side of his face. The movie they were discussing went on to win 4 Academy Awards and 2 Golden Globes and made nearly $1 billion worldwide. After some more stories, it's midnight. The outdoor bar has closed and my wine glass is empty. A passing server offers to find me a refill, but it's a perfect excuse to mosey to the bar inside where it's quiet and warm and get a few minutes to myself. The bartender comes over and leans on the bar expectantly.
"What'll it be, gorgeous?"
Whatever your best red wine is, I tell him, reading his name tag, Woody. I was drinking the Pinot outside, but I think they ran out a while ago. Woody smiles, revealing a top row of perfectly white, even teeth, with one front tooth completely missing. It's such an odd paradox, I am instantly fascinated. Was it pulled? If so, why? How could one tooth be so bad when the others are perfect? These are the things that take up brain space that should be used to come up with snappy comebacks when Brad calls me kiddo or sport and insists that being a team player means I pass someone else my commission. I'll give you the Ravenswood Zin, then, he says, rapping his knuckles against the bar. Not much to choose from, but that one is pretty decent. Woody leaves to go grab a bottle, and I lean more heavily against the bar, wondering for a beat if I could just lay my head down here and take a little nap. Oh, wine makes me sleepy. And amorous, apparently, because tonight, Carter is looking pretty... How's it going over here? Straightening, I look over my shoulder as the man himself approaches and pulls out the bar stool next to me. It's a struggle to keep my tipsy attention focused on his face and not stare at the smooth, exposed collarbone. I'm wiped and tipsy. I just want to head to bed.
Me too.
Glancing to the doors he's just come in through, he adds,
but I fear they're just getting started.
I find myself leaning into him, laughing into the shoulder of his jacket. God, he smells good. Crazy kids. I guess we can't just disappear, being the hosts and all. He laughs. How the fuck did we manage to get this gig? No idea. He looks down, running the tip of his index finger back and forth over a pattern in the wood bar top.
Brad is still treating you like his assistant.
I know. I bite my lip, looking to the side.
Evie,
he says,
I'm so sorry. I contributed by ignoring it. I don't want to do that anymore.
His words make my windpipe feel tight, make my thoughts turn defensive. Everything's fine. You're just new to this, Carter. I've dealt with Brad for years. I know his game. Cut the shit, Evie. Letting out a tiny steam whistle of vulnerability, I admit. It always makes me mad, but now it's making me anxious. I have this strange itch in the back of my brain, this persistent worry that he's really trying to push me out. He nods.
I see it. I see it, and I don't know what to do.
My chest, it aches. I hate feeling helpless. I didn't expect this to be our crescendo moment. In the movies, these admissions either soften someone up or harden them further, but they rarely come out as quietly as I've said it and still make a huge impact. But somehow this one does. Carter leans down and slides his hand along my jaw and then bends, kissing me in a way I've been dreaming about almost nonstop since that night in my apartment. It's different from the frantic kisses in the mixing room, rough and hurried. Those felt like secret, semi-violent betrayals of our better instincts. But this is a stream of tiny tastes and pecks, little pieces of dialogue. They go from, I'm sorry, to, what are we doing, to, how do we do this deeper and all night? And I don't even notice when Woody has to place my drink on the bar because Carter has my back pressed to it. I do notice when Carter pulls away to hand him a 20. My hand comes up, pressing to my mouth as if holding the sensation there. You don't have to pay for my wine.
I'm invested in getting this tab settled so we can leave.
I thought we couldn't leave our party.
Fuck this party.
The giggle that escapes me is high and girlish, and very excited at the prospect of us leaving together. What did you say? I ask, mock scandalized.
You heard me.
Drunken roars reach